The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
Yes, Helen is once again not here for the New Statesman podcast, but she will be back next week. Anoush has very kindly agreed to step in. Helen might not be back, but Parliament is. Effortless segue there. How's their first couple of days back gone?
Yeah, I was in Westminster yesterday and I...
The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber, who offer their drivers worker protections and a range of benefits, including access to fully funded undergraduate degree courses through the Open University.
It's like a dream that was something that was missing from myself.
Sanan Ahmed has been driving with Uber for 8 years.
I start driving with Uber because it provides flexibility. You can work whenever you want. I couldn't complete my studies before. I had a huge gap of almost 5 years. When I get into IT, I was working full-time with Uber and they gave the opportunity like you can study while you work. With the Open University, it was the same thing. It's flexible. You can take your lectures whenever you're free. I've studied a bachelor's in business management, graduated last year. Currently, I'm doing my master's. The impact that Uber and Open University had on my future, I'm very positive. Now I've got goals that I've set for myself, and before there was no way I could achieve it. But now I feel like I'm in the right direction.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
I don't know how you felt, because I think you were also stalking its corridors as well. But it felt like a very, very tense mood, I thought. I mean, at least among some of the Labour staffers and MPs as well. I think people obviously know that the Labour leadership result is a foregone conclusion and now they're really panicking about what comes next, particularly with this idea of shadow cabinet elections. The party did vote for it, but I think that there are some people, particularly those who served in the shadow cabinet before resigning, who actually don't know how it's going to be a way over the hurdle of, but I don't support my leader. And I also think that there's a feeling, I don't know whether you've picked this up, but there's a feeling among some of those people that it would sort of be a patch over a problem that's going to get worse and worse. So I think they think that Jeremy Corbyn's going to solve everything by actually bringing this new system in. He's going to think he's solved everything, but actually it's just going to cover deeper wounds within the party.
Yeah, I mean, and also shadow cabinet elections are an appalling idea.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, I mean, obviously Jeremy is being hugely hypocritical in that he and John McDonnell were supporters of shadow cabinet elections for a long time, but they were wrong. It doesn't work. The leader should pick their cabinet. You know, it may be that Jeremy Corbyn cannot win the next election. However, his only chance is if he has a chancellor who he agrees with on fiscal and economic policy. As, you know, as Ed Balls and Ed Miliband aptly proved. Actually, that's the thing we forget about Blair and Brown. They might have disagreed about who should lead, but there was not a great gulf of policy between them. The leader should pick the cabinet. Obviously dysfunctional otherwise.
Exactly, and also it gives Jeremy Corbyn a chance, if he were to continue appointing shadow cabinet positions, to appoint the broad church that he actually needs. But it would have to be a willing broad church.
And
it would be on his watch, and therefore he would reap the benefits if it actually worked out.
What I thought was interesting, and I am in the process of, so I may have written by the time this comes out, although who knows. What I thought was interesting was actually the fall off in support for the anti-Corbyn faction, as it were, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
160 MPs voted to get rid of shadow cabinet elections. That is obviously less than the 172 who voted to no confidence. But it's even fewer, because obviously there were some people who didn't vote for the no confidence, but who went, now he's lost it, he needs to go, right? So actually the diehard, we just need to keep on attacking until he dies.
Yes.
Tendency. The tide is coming in on them, but very slowly. But yeah, I mean, because I think like a lot of people on, well, not a lot, obviously, because actually, what, so 15, so basically 19 people on the right of, you know, not just on the right, you know, among the Corbyn skeptic tendency, recognise that you can't change the rules just to suit you, and shadow cabinet elections were bad.
Yes, yeah.
But it is just such a bizarro dividing line.
Yeah, no, exactly, because it doesn't benefit the people who want to bring them in. And I don't really know, but I think they're just trying everything. This is just a symptom of probably every single faction of the Labour Party trying not to split, aside from maybe the Corbynites. But yeah, I just think there is a fear that the party is going to split. And if it does, then it means Jeremy Corbyn's won. And so all those people who are sceptical about him, or all those people who tried to make it work but couldn't quite make it work with him, are now thinking, what are the little rule changes that we can bring in? How can we fiddle around the edges to make sure that this doesn't happen and we don't lose our party? And that's another sign of the fact that usually it's I don't like to use the term the right of the party, but the more centrist wing of the party is actually more tribal in a way than those who are Corbyn's allies.
Yeah, I think particularly because that generation of politicians are primarily a generation of people who join the Labour Party rather than joining the SDP. So
yes,
they are more tribal than the generation before them, and I think the generation afterwards.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but it feels like when I talk to staffers about a split, on whether they're on the left or the right of the Labour Party, they're like, oh, you know, it wouldn't be so bad not to have to deal with...
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
But the MP's like, no, I was born in this party and I'll die in it. Yeah, it's a really interesting fissure. Mm. The other... Yeah, obviously, the government is now back. And I think one of the interesting unreported aspects of Theresa May's psyche is her affection for the Conservative Party.
Yes.
Yeah, and she really wants to keep the Tory party together and for it to survive Brexit, which, yeah, many people at the top of the Tory party do think that the ambiguities, if you're being polite, of the Brexit campaign will destroy the Conservative Party. And I think she's done a very good job so far of not upsetting any part of her party and reassuring the markets, although it is starting to unravel a bit, it feels like.
I do think it will unravel a bit now that they're back in the Commons. They're being asked questions from both sides. Like the Brexit ministers are going to be hammered from both sides of the House on what they're taking to Brussels, what deal they're trying to thrash out. So I do think that calculated, I'm saying nothing but I'm being reassuring, I'm a steady hand kind of performance, like the interview she gave to Mar over the weekend, her first proper big interview. I think that will start to erode a bit. But like you say, she has been reassuring all the sides of her party. I don't know what you think, but I actually think the people on the left of the Tory party, the more pro-Remain side, are more reassured in a way. Lots of them are saying, well, I think they have a feeling that she is far too sensible and has far too much affection for the unity of her party, like you mentioned, to let the party slide to the right, even with a weak opposition who aren't holding her to account, and even with like some quite right-wing senior ministers in her government. She doesn't look like she's going to let that happen. She's too sensible to let that happen. That's what some of the feelings are, I think, among those ex-ministers who would have liked to remain outcome.
Yeah, I think, and actually even among, I mean, obviously you expect people who've remained ministers to be more cheery, but, you know, there are people in that government who were talking, you know, who were using words like "this is the worst day in British history."
Yes.
Who, you know, it's not they're now thinking it was good. They still think it was a mistake, but they are definitely reassured. They are, I think, reassured, and both the Prime Minister and the Chancellor were also campaigning for Remain. And there's a feeling that she won't have the kind of hard Brexit than might have the more destructive economic consequences. No. Although, of course, all of this presupposes on the idea that there is a good deal to be struck.
Exactly. Like whenever we have these conversations, we always forget that there's another side to the negotiating table. So I don't actually know whether or not the sort of Remain-friendly Brexit dream will actually be achieved. Although there is some confidence that in Boris Johnson being actually someone who didn't necessarily believe wholeheartedly in Brexit and knows full well the benefits of economic migrants. So there's a bit of confidence in him there as well, despite the fact that he was a bit Machiavellian during the campaign.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that she's done, which is very effective, is that by binding in those three Brexiteers, I think if Boris has any hope of having a second coming, as it were, then it has to be at the end of a successful Theresa May government. He's intimately implicated in the success or failure of the whole enterprise. Although she is coming under more pressure under the Commons now because people ask questions. Jacques Ramouna had a very good backbench question in the Select Committee. And I think Select Committees are going to be the place where the complexities of Brexit start to properly prey upon the government. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So Theresa May has finally told the world, or at least told Tory MPs, what we've all long suspected, which is that she favours a new breed of grammar schools. And she made this clear at the 1922 committee last night, having been remarkably coy in interviews before this. She said she does favour an element of selection, i.e. new grammar schools. And to her detractors, she issued quite a sharp rebuke, saying that, of course, we already have selection. It's selection by house prices.
Yeah. So in terms of the policy, the consensus among policymakers is fairly uniform that they're bad. The consensus among the public is fairly uniform that they are good, which is a bit of a reversal because obviously by the time they were abolished, they were unpopular. The parliamentary maths is a bit more fraught. They have a small majority, and we don't yet know how it is that the Tory sceptics of grammar schools will jump. How likely is it, do you think, that it will make it through the House of Parliament in the end?
I think it all depends on the detail. So at the moment, she's suggesting that they will try to make grammar schools more inclusive than in the past. That could mean quotas for pupils on free school meals. That could mean them only being established in particular areas. So I think it depends on how radical the policy is. But you're right, the parliamentary maths is quite tricky in the Commons and also in the Lords, where, of course, the Tories have no majority at all. And the Salisbury Convention, as it's known, is that the Lords can't block items which have appeared in a party's manifesto. But, of course, in the case of grammar schools, if you look back at the 2015 Tory manifesto, it says we'll allow existing grammars to expand. It says nothing about new grammar schools. And it's for reasons like this that some still believe Theresa May should hold an early election and win a mandate of her own. So she has most likely a larger Conservative majority for new policies. Yeah. Because the line from Number 10 has always been, we are sticking to the 2015 Conservative manifesto. Now, a lot of people feel that on grammar schools, at least, she's broken that commitment.
Of course, she has the advantage. And in some ways, with grammar schools, losing on it is not that bad of a problem, particularly because the people who would lead that rebellion would be the people who are her biggest threats: Michael Gove, George Osborne, Nick Bowles. If they break with the Tory right over grammar schools, there is no way back to them to the top table.
Yes, indeed. And Theresa May is clearly a sincere believer in grammar schools. But from a party management perspective, it's very helpful for her to have the Tory right on side on this. Because their fear, of course, is that down the line in the Brexit negotiations, though the right are fairly pleased with May at the moment, that she won't get enough on immigration to satisfy them. David Cameron, of course, suffered that experience. And if she can say, I'm delivering on grammar schools, that is a big chunk of red meat for them. But then, of course, we also know from experience that the Tory right tend never to be satisfied. And so I think it would be wrong and premature to conclude that if she makes the right noises in areas such as grammar schools, that they'll give her a pass on Brexit, because they clearly won't.
Well, so confrontations to come between Theresa May and the Conservative right, and we'll be back to discuss them all next week.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hi, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John, and we host Skylines, a City Metric podcast, where every 2 weeks we talk about cities, maps and the human world.
Whether the Olympics are good for cities, what it's like to be a woman in a city, and we've had guests like Lauren Elkin, Caroline Criado-Perez.
And Neil Codlin, keyboard player from Suede, because I'm nearly cool now.
Tune in on iTunes or on Acast.
Check it out.
And we're joined in our second section by our culture writer and co-host obviously with Caroline, who's not here, co-host of the Seriously podcast, Anna Leskovich.
That's me, hello.
To talk about how political supporters of political parties increasingly borrow from the language of fandom.
Yeah, which is something that I suppose has been happening for a while. I think it's one of those things that's quite easy to overestimate how much it's happened in the last few years. And I think people always remember like the Hope Obama t-shirts, and there's something of the band t-shirt about that, sort of the way you wear that with pride and you use it to start conversations with other people who share your enthusiasm for a person or a topic. But the way it's been manifesting itself recently, I guess, is in the Hillary and Trump campaigns mostly. We can all remember the Miller fandom stuff from last year. And I think the interesting thing that's happening in America at the moment is that sort of idealization of your political, whoever you support politically. It's not so, it's less of a like, well, on balance, I think they're the best choice. And it often becomes more of a sort of identity based issue. So there's been some great stuff on this. So Trump's supporters have a sort of language all of their own. I don't know if you see people using things like, saying like give this man a coat is a thing, which means like giving someone a reward. If you say someone's a centipede, that's a compliment, because there's this weird viral video that went around ages ago of like some nature documentary talking about the centipede being like a nimble navigator. So nimble navigator is also a compliment. And that was interspersed with like Trump talking at some sort of event ages ago. And they love that kind of stuff. And there's all this like, you know, Reddit style language of like cuck and stuff like that comes with the Trump campaign. And it, to me, that smacks of fandom, because you often have these little in jokes that you use as a way of like identifying each other. And it's like any sort of in-group language development.
I just want to stop you. So how would you pronounce cuck?
I would say cuck, because it's okay. Like cuckolded, isn't it?
So I've been pronouncing it cuck as in cuckoo.
Oh, no.
No. Oh, no.
You're obviously not tapped into the men's rights movement.
Yeah, I feel like I like Anna a lot, but whenever you come on the podcast, I feel old.
I'm so sorry.
You know, that judge, she's like, who is Gazza? What is the Snapchat?
Well, you know, I'm glad to be that presence in your life, Stephen. Makes me feel young. And then I think that's interesting, because with the Trump campaign, a lot of that seems to be coming from the bottom up. It's not really Trump who's leading this stuff. Mm. Whereas in the Hillary campaign, you see a lot more of her sort of mimicking the language of fandom in her tweets, in her social activity, that sort of stuff. And sometimes that can be a bit hit and miss. Like when she did that, tell us how you feel about your student debt in 3 emojis or less. Well, that's not immediately borrowing from fandom. It is trying to tap into that teen, young online sort of vibe, and it's people really didn't like it. So it can be a bit hit and miss in that way.
So where does Jeremy Corbyn come into this? Because obviously we've not seen a politician in Britain revered quite in the way that he is, and obviously they have the t-shirts and the badges, and it's very much an identity thing. So do you think, is that more grassroots up or top down?
I think it's definitely grassroots up, and I think a lot of it is projection, which is a huge thing in fandom, is saying like, you know, even with like queering fandom narratives and stuff, you're not getting that from the thing itself. So I think a lot of the time with like this idea of Jeremy Corbyn being like an intersexual feminist icon, how much of that have we actually seen from Jeremy Corbyn, and how much of that relates to the fact that all his supporters are both Jeremy Corbyn fans and identify as intersectional feminists? So I think that's where a lot of this stuff can be compared to fandom, in that you get people like loving Star Trek and shipping gay narratives in it because a lot of people are watching Star Trek and they're also gay. But it's not actually that there's all this stuff coming from Star Trek that is suggesting those gay narratives, which can be a great thing and it can be a tricky thing. It's neither a positive nor a negative, I think.
I have a kind of chicken and egg question. This might just be the people who I talk to at party conferences, but Anoush, my feeling, and certainly my impression whenever we get emails for suggestions to talk about on the second item in the podcast, is the average person who is seriously political tends to be interested in at least one thing, like Doctor Who, video games, Star Trek, kind of popular cult shows within existing...
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, fandom and political activity, it feels to me, have always been closely linked, obviously, particularly and most noticeably with the Liberal Democrats.
I think that's definitely true. Maybe there is something about following one particular aspect of culture sort of obsessively, knowing the characters, predicting what's going to happen, and being able to talk about it authoritatively in front of your friends and your colleagues. I think there is a similarity there. And I have found that from hardcore politicos who I've spoken to. There's also a similar thing in the way that I think you've been writing a bit about this, how British politics people are obsessed with the American election in a way that they might be obsessed with watching a television program, because it never quite reflects the reality of what they supposedly know so much about.
Yeah, it's a bit like being like supporting, I don't know, Daenerys Targaryen in Game of Thrones, and you can sort of mentally know that in real life you actually wouldn't like to meet this person and she's actually violent and stuff.
Yeah.
And you can like take all that away and be like, no, she's like absolutely slaying, like no. And you can talk about Hillary or someone like that in those terms and just be like, yeah, she absolutely destroyed Trump with that tweet, and see them as a character rather than thinking of them as like a... And I'm not saying that that's a terrible thing and, you know, political supporters are deluding themselves. I just think it's a different way of viewing politicians.
I wonder if it can, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but maybe it can lead to a greater sense of betrayal when you have been projecting all of these things onto the person who you so admire, and then they do let you down. So we had an element of that when there were lots of Jeremy Corbyn fans who were obviously very pro remaining in the EU because they were of that demographic. And then when they saw that he wasn't quite wholeheartedly behind that, a few of them did feel extremely let down. And that obviously is unreasonable because he's never been a fan of the European Union.
Yeah, if you look at his voting record, it doesn't match up.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's part of it. Definitely.
You also actually have the weird kind of fan thing of... So obviously there's a perfectly respectable position, which is to go, I care about the EU, but I care about having a platform from the Labour left more, but which some people have reached. But you also have people going, oh no, actually he does clearly like the EU because of this thing he said in episode 72. And it's like,
it becomes a rewrite in that sense. It's like retconning in TV shows and stuff. Yeah. And then you also get this sort of the cuddliness of Jeremy Corbyn, I think, comes out of that as well, because you get all these like people memeing pictures of him on his bike in his tracksuit, and then that's the only Jeremy Corbyn they want to see. They want to see Jeremy Corbyn on his bike and Jeremy Corbyn refusing to sing the national anthem or whatever, and then that's the sort of picture of him that you can build, but you're leaving out other things as well.
Yeah, and what's strange is like that's how he rose to power in a way, by all of these people sort of designing this character that they could really get on board with. And actually there was something really appealing about it because there's no other politicians who are quite like him. But with Ed Miliband, it came right at the end of his campaign, just before the general election, people started photoshopping like wreaths onto his head and stuff
Yeah,
like that.
And there's a slight difference between those two things, because although a lot of the people supporting Ed Miliband said, you know, this isn't a joke, there is something funny, and they know there is, about the disjunct between the flower crown and this guy who looks really weird. Yeah. And they can be like, oh my god, he's so cute, and the reason they think he's so cute is because he doesn't look quite right, and that's all part of that. Whereas with Jeremy Corbyn, I see a lot more of like people really feeling very seriously about the pictures of him on the bus and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it feels a bit more earnest. I also think it felt to me that some of the Miller fandom was people who were engaged in geek culture, who were also political, mm-hmm. who were enjoying being political in the same way they enjoyed their other hobbies.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas it is definitely less fun.
Yeah, it's a little bit more of an...
Labour Party in general, less fun than it was a year ago. There is yet to be Owen Smith fan side, but...
Yeah, but maybe he'll have a Miliband rush towards the end, which will do nothing for his electoral chances.
You can see, you know, the sad Keanu meme?
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Like, you can feel Owen Smith might finally become the sad Keanu, like, you know...
I think that's right. There is this picture of him with a cup of tea. Have you seen it? With the little china cup with, I think, holly leaves on it or something. And he looks so sad looking into his cup of tea. So that might be one.
We literally love a politician as an underdog once they're already on the way out, don't we?
Yeah. My favourite sad series was Getty suddenly published all these pictures of Natalie Bennett looking sad on a park bench with like a really strange grey filter on it.
Yeah. That's all marvellous.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you very much. And we'll be back next week. And now it's time for You Ask Us, a section in which you ask us a question. Thanks so much for all of your questions this week. The ones on basic income were, I thought, a little too complex for the format of the podcast, so I've tackled that in a blog post. But yeah, please do keep emailing, tweeting. I also have a public Facebook page where you can ask these questions now. So please keep up with that. This one's about the Boundary Review, which is happening it's being released next week. Seats will be reduced from 650 to 600. Most seats will materially change. And there's an idea that this will be the mechanic whereby Jeremy Corbyn is able to transform the parliamentary party as he has transformed Labour's grassroots. But there is a very good question, which is, will this actually help him at all? Because obviously what happens is your constituency changes, you get 40%, if you have 40% of the new seat under Labour's rules, it's yours, you get to keep it, you don't have to go through a full selection.
It's a normal selection process, yeah. It's the ordinary trigger ballot thing that you'd have to do, even, you know, just normally running for that seat in the next election.
And the thing with trigger ballot is so basically every constituent branch of a Labour Party, a local Labour Party, has one vote, as it were, in a trigger ballot. So you can alienate your members and lose 75-25, but if you keep your local trade union branch's officials on side, you will mostly be fine.
Exactly, and it can work the other way around as well. And it's just a simple yes-no vote. Yeah. Yes, we do want them to be selected for the seat again. No, we don't.
It's actually more likely to work the other way around because there's obviously... many more trade union branches because they can affiliate unlimited numbers.
Yes.
The interesting power player to watch is the shop workers union, because obviously what does every constituency have more of than any other workplace? Supermarkets. It will be hard. The question is, if you have two people with 40% claims. However, one of the more interesting things about the Parliamentary Labour Party is actually these are geographical factions as much as they are political ones, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So if you are a Jeremy Corbyn supporter, or you're in his office and you see these two seats up against one another and you hope that your desired candidate wins against the MP that you'd quite like to be deselected, you're not likely to see that situation come up often across the country, because you do have neighbours who are similar geographically. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's unlikely that you will have your side of the fight in neighbouring seats.
Yeah. For the most part. So there'll be some interesting, there may be some interesting battles in London.
Mm.
If so, for example, last time Hackney went down to one seat, that would have meant Meg Hillier and Diane Abbott, who are from very different ends of the Labour Party.
Would be, yeah.
Yeah. So in London, there is the potential for some proper ideological set tos.
Mm.
In large parts of the country, I imagine what will happen is the least Corbyn-friendly MP will be the one left without a seat when the music stops. But it will be fairly difficult. You can technically, because if they've both got a 40% claim, they go on a runoff.
Yeah.
Technically, you can vote for reopen nominations. In practice, my instinct is that won't happen. People are always reluctant to vote for reopen nominations in any contest. Mm. And I think there will... And the thing we saw last time is people don't really trust or understand AV. So I think if, say, you're a situation where, say, Frank Field, who's compared Andy Corbyn's members to execution squads, is fighting over a seat with Angela Eagle, which, they're both MPs on the Wirral, so that could very easily happen.
Exactly.
I imagine that one of them will triumph because people go like, well, whatever I want, I don't want so-and-so getting back in.
Yeah.
So it will be difficult to rearrange the parliamentary party that way. It feels more likely to me than some MPs will lose their trigger ballots. If you've irritated your local trade unions, which really, to be honest, ought not to be a left-right thing.
Mm.
Actually, a lot of fairly right-wing MPs are quite on side with their local left-wing trade. If you're doing your job as a local MP, in many cases, you ought to be fine with that. Some people are getting fairly nervous, though they have, for various reasons, they have come a cropper with their local big employers, etc., etc. And actually, your local employers are much easier to keep on side with than voters, because boundary changes means that you can gain or lose 100 members every 5 years. But if you are, say, one of the MPs in Newcastle, Nissan is the ball game as far as your affiliated union branches are, regardless of what your boundaries are. So yes, that was a very long-winded way of saying it will be more difficult than people commonly suppose. However, my instinct is the PLP, in terms of the candidates who go for election in 2020, will be much more Corbyn-friendly than the PLP as it exists now.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.